We don't encounter a reef just as a fixed thing. It is something that varies according to our circumstances. It's something in our mind as well as a constellation of corals. And it's varied and changed with people over generations.
Because it's the giganticism of the place that has so often tricked Europeans.
Absolutely. And I think there are probably lots of our listeners today in Australia who don't realise just how big the reef is. It is a country. It's bigger than Belgium. By a long chalk, in fact, it's as big as Japan or as big as Britain and Ireland put together. That's the Barrier Reef.
Your own personal encounter with the reef came relatively recently. It started what's become a 12-year romance, but it certainly didn't start romantically on board the three-masted bark, the HMAS Endeavour. Why was that experience life-changing?
It was a really scary and horrific kind of experience in many ways, and I think intended to be. It was reality TV. The important thing is that you have people crack up and hurt themselves and so on. So in one sense, it was a really awful experience. But in another sense, sailing through the reef, not with a motor, but under sail, as Cook had done centuries before, not disturbing the wildlife, and seeing this exquisite place close up, because you don't go fast on those boats. You can see the coral under the water. You can see the animals. But we could also see, as I tracked Cook's journals, how few animals were left since his time. The fact is that the whole environment had changed.
And that was part of your epiphany. It came during an expedition to a hill on Lizard Island, the very same hill that Captain Cook had climbed more than 200 years earlier. What was it about that day that so troubled you? Because you were troubled by it.
I was troubled. I was troubled and exhilarated at the same time, because Lizard Island is an exquisite, exquisite island, and it's very Australian. You have to get rid of the idea that the Barrier Reef is a South Sea paradise. It's an Australian paradise, and it's a rugged, rugged kind of environment. And we climbed up that hill and looked out over the reef in the same way that Cook did, trying to find a break through the reef so he could get the hell out of where he was trapped. And we went with a young biologist, and as we came back down, she talked to us about the corals around, and though they were protecting them and looking after them, these corals were starting to die from bleaching. And she showed us an example down at the bottom of bleached corals, these white skeletons. And I just had this terrible feeling that this thing that we'd been seeing, this stretching out into the horizon, it was so precious and it was dying. She was telling us it was dying. So that was a life-changing moment for me.
You start your story, or at least the European part of your story, with Captain Cook, and why not? The story is very well known. The Endeavour hitting the reef, the ship beached at Cooktown and expertly repaired. But what's the deeper significance of this accidental encounter?
Well, I think it's one of the most important moments in our history, actually, and it's surprisingly neglected in that sense, because this is the moment where, for the first time, Europeans had sustained contact with indigenous people, and contact on their terms. The Europeans were marooned. That's how they felt themselves. They didn't know if they were going to get away from Cooktown. They had scurvy. They were suffering from lack of food. And when they encountered the indigenous people, a massive number of misunderstandings and a struggle that took place really over resources, because the Europeans stole the key resources of the local people, which was turtle.
And it was a fatal encounter too.
It was a fatal encounter. They took away the turtle on which these people depend, without realising in a way that it belonged to them. They thought it was wild. It wasn't. It was how they managed. And that encounter led to an armed struggle between them, and blood was literally spilt. In the end, thanks in fact to the generosity of the local people, there was a kind of, I suppose you would call it, a reconnection was made, and in a peaceful way. So it was a story of reconciliation, reconciliation triggered by the indigenous people.
On Radio National Breakfast, you're listening to historian Ian McCalman. He's the author of The Reef, A Passionate History. Ian McCalman, you use a 14-year-old boy, a 14-year-old French cabin boy, Narcisse Pelletier, to tell a much bigger story about castaways. There's quite a few castaways in your story, but Pelletier became a dugong man, an initiated warrior. What's the significance and the symbolism of this story?
Greg, the great thing about these castaways who were cast away at a very young age and lived with Indigenous people for basically the formative years of their life and became Indigenous. I mean, there was no way that Pelletier thought of himself as Narcisse Pelletier after he'd been with them for 17 years. He was Anko, a man of the Wantala. And he was an initiated warrior with scarifications on his chest, a big timber earlobe that dragged his ear down. He was a very strong and good warrior who excelled in one of the most important ways of excelling among these marine people, which is in hunting dugong from canoes.
And the significance of that, as I read his story, was the country of those people extended further east into the reef area than it did west onto land.
That's right. That's right. I'm really glad you noticed that because these Indigenous people did not distinguish between the sea and the land. They were part of the same thing. They flowed in each other. The sea was where they got their resources from. They went out in these canoes that were quite fragile vessels in a way, you know, 40 kilometres out into the water to hunt. Their country was a country of land and sea, and we've never acknowledged that.
The Pelletier story ends tragically. He's found or captured in 1875. He's forced to re-enter European society, but forever disparaged as the savage.
That's right. It is a tragic story because this boy had left. He could barely remember his parents. You know, he was 14 when he was wrecked, and he was 31 when he arrived back in France. He was welcomed by his parents, but they were actually quite horrified by him. He appeared to be a savage, and he was proud of it. He'd regained some of his French, but he was proud of being a Wantala man, and the sand beach was his country back over the sea. In some ways, he's the first of the stolen children. He's been stolen from his own country, and there he is in France, which is to some extent an alien place.
How much do you think he died of a broken heart?
That's exactly what I think. It's what people at the time said. They said he died of la nostalgie, nostalgia for his home, and his home was the sand beaches of the Great Barrier Reef, thousands of kilometres away. Yeah, I think he did die of a broken heart.
William Saville Kent was the first professional scientist to work on the reef, but it was only a brief 4 years from 1888 to 1891. The reef became Saville Kent's personal and professional salvation, and he ignited a huge public imagination and awareness of the reef, both in Australia and internationally. What's the significance of Saville Kent's story?
It's a tough story, but it begins with the fact that this was a deeply troubled man. He had grown up in a very, very traumatic household. His father had given syphilis to his mother and then treated her, basically almost locked her away. She went mad and died. He married, first of all, had an affair with and then married the governess, who then had children, who was very cruel to the original children. So in a very tragic incident, his older sister at 15 and him almost certainly at 14 secretly killed their 3.5-year-old brother. If that had happened today, they would have been put into medical care because they were children who'd been driven to the edge of torment. What happened in short was that the sister took the rap for him, and she went into prison for 22 years, and he became a scientist. But he was a tormented and difficult man, and really he fled to Australia to escape the possible scandal of when his sister got out of jail. I mean,
but the reef became his salve in a way, his salve and his salvation.
Absolutely. The reef did two or three things for him. One is he was a scientist, He was an artist and he was a technologist.
And an egomaniac.
And an egomaniac. But it brought all those three talents together. So, you know, as a scientist, he was trying to get oysters and other kinds of resources of the reef to be revitalized because they're already becoming exhausted. But as a scientist, he was fascinated by the new species. As an artist, he wanted to photograph them and to paint them. And as a technologist, he was trying, in fact, to discover how to culture pearls using technology. So the reef, and of course, living in a place as he was in the Torres Strait, was like living on the frontier.
There was the first inklings of the modern age, though, because what got him the job as the Inspector of Fisheries was concern about threats to the reef and overexploitation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Already as early as the 1880s, several of the reef resource trades, like pearl shells.
Bêche de mer.
Yeah, bêche de mer or trepang, as people call it. These were already exhausted. So the Queensland was losing its revenue. And so they hired him, in effect, to try and revive these resources.
He's great. Moment of triumph was his monumental and famous book, published in 1893, called The Great Barrier Reef, Its Products and Potentialities. How much did Savile Kent still represent a fairly utilitarian worldview of nature, of the wonder and the beauty of the reef, that it was all subservient basically to us?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a tremendous tension underlying that book. There's the artist who's absolutely dazzled by the beauty of the reef and the creatures in it. And the scientist, it's full of mysteries and wonders he wants to solve. But he's also there as a resource manager for the government. And, you know, he sees the reef as something to be exploited and to be turned into money. There's no doubt about that. But the book has all those tensions in it. And it is a beautiful...
His book, not yours.
His book, yeah, his book.
The modern battle to save the Great Barrier Reef from the 1960s, essentially, you call, poetically, I think, you're using poetic license, war. Its genesis is an unusual partnership between a poet, an artist, and a scientist. Who on earth were these people?
They were three pretty ordinary citizens. I mean, Judith Wright was a great poet, perhaps our greatest poet at that time, at any rate. And the artist was a guy called John Boost, who not a very good artist, a kind of bohemian dropout artist with a bit of money, who lived on the reef for a long time, unbuttoned kind of life. And the scientist was a pretty much self-made working class rural boy called Len Webb, who'd become a forester and ecologist.
And Australia's great rainforest scientist.
A great rainforest scientist.
Got the connection between the reef and the rainforest.
Absolutely, absolutely, and taught them. I mean, one of the symbolic things that's so wonderful about this is a fusion of art, humanities and science, you know, that I think we need if the reef is to be saved, and in fact, if all our environmental problems are to be dealt with. But this was a fusion of these three, and they taught each other the things that they knew. Len taught them what ecology was. Judith Wright taught Len what sensibility meant, you know, the sentiment, the importance of feeling, and how feeling is a form of intelligence. So it was a wonderful symbolic connection, but it's also wonderful because they were ordinary citizens. I mean, they'd never engaged in politics before.
And I think the significance of it is, despite the size of the reef, it's 2,300 kilometre length, it's 3,000 reefs, it's 1,000 islands, that campaign essentially was very much a local affair.
It was. And it's so encouraging to know that ordinary citizens in a locality, in places, you know, places like Brisbane and in Mission Beach, they can mobilize the entire society, which they did, against a very powerful group of enemies, mining magnates, government ministers, and many others who were leveled against them.
The idea for the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park, protection for all of the reef, you credit to John Buist. What happened? What did John Buist do?
Well, he probably wasn't the first person to actually think about the importance of a marine Park, but he was the first person to spell it out as a political agenda. And what he did, he's a very shrewd man, John Boost. He had known Harold Holt very well as a boy. They grew up at school together, and then they lived close to each other on the reef. He persuaded them to buy a house and love the reef. And so when Harold Holt died, Boost wrote to LBJ, then still the President of the United States, saying, "Can you propose a Great Barrier Reef Marine Park in honour of Harold Holt, a man who loved the Great Barrier Reef? Can you suggest and promote a Great Barrier Reef Marine Park that would honour his memory?"
What a great vision. The last personal story that you tell in the book is Australian coral scientist John Charlie Verin. Why is Charlie Verin's story so important?
I've called him in the book the Darwin of the coral. He was nicknamed after Darwin as a six-year-old by his school teacher.
And his obsession since childhood with evolution.
Absolutely. He's been obsessed with evolution. But like Darwin, he was a person who engaged with nature face-to-face. It's really because Charlie dived 7,000 hours underwater, got to know the reefs of the world as they lived in their living characteristic, that he became such a great scientist. But the important thing about him is his passion for the reef. He lives in there. He swims in it. He lives in it. It is his life. He embodies the reef.
And he's very happy to be a defender of it.
Absolutely. He's fighting to this day. He believes that the reef is in trouble.
You put the heat on us. You finish the book by noting that as Australians, yes, we ultimately are the global caretakers of the Great Barrier Reef. If we fail in that task, what have we lost?
Well, one of the first things we've lost is our own identity. A massive part of what constitutes an Australian is what people think of the phenomenon of the reef, the enormous and beautiful waters, the fish. We're a water people. We're people who live on the coast, and this is our greatest stretch of coast. We lose an enormous amount of our identity and our history, but we also lose our honour as world citizens who've been given this privilege for our own benefit, but also for the benefit of the world. And that's our responsibility.
Ian McCallman, it's a terrific read, The Reef, A Passionate History. Thank you very much for talking about it with us today on Breakfast.
Thanks, Greg. It's been a pleasure.